Should I say welcome to another exciting edition of the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, proudly brought to you in partnership with GorillaMedia.co.nz, New Zealand's unconventional news. Tunisian army vows to protect revolution. And this is a first. I've not seen the state armies actually protect revolutions before. The head of Tunisia's armed forces, Rashid Ammar, has pledged to safeguard the country's historic revolution against any possible deviations. Ammar made the pledge to a crowd of anti-government protesters in the capital, Tunis, on Monday. And I'm pretty sure that they're real happy that they won't get exterminated by their army, as will happen to the people of the United States. The National Army is the guarantor of the revolution. The army has protected and protects the people and the country, he said. Well, isn't that very nice? And the remarks came as police clashed with protesters camping outside the office of interim Prime Minister Mohamed Ghannouchi, the Premier's office, calling on the government to resign. Now, I would think that any type of civil unrest can wind up being a bit of a danger to the general populace, right? Unless, of course, the general populace is just going, the government's to blame, and actually focusing the energy where it is needed most. Unlike vigilante activations, and this is an article in from Guerrilla Media, in the past 3 days, over a dozen police officers have been shot across the US. All right, that supposedly this was triggered by the shooting in Tucson. That story leaves a lot covered up and may not be revealed for some time to come. But that is not all that is happening. The suicide bomber at Moscow Airport yesterday killed 35 people and wounded over 150 others a couple of weeks ago. It was warned a couple of weeks ago that would become unsafe to be in public locations and that attacks would start to occur in Europe and North America. This is only the beginning. Last week also saw 2 people killed in a Walmart in Port Orchard, Washington. Assaults on the public are increasing. Speaking of which, food speculations. Anybody ever heard of this? You can like bet on food prices and stuff like that, and when you bet, the food prices go up and people die of starvation. People die from hunger while banks make a killing on starvation on food. It's not just bad harvests and that kind of thing. It's also speculators that are behind record prices, and it's the planet's poorest who pay. Just under 3 years ago, people in the village of Gumbi in western Malawi went unexpectedly hungry, not like Europeans do if they miss a meal or two, but that deep, gnawing hunger that prevents sleep and dulls the senses when there has been no food for weeks. Oddly, there'd been no drought, the usual cause of malnutrition and hunger in southern Africa, and there was plenty of food in the markets. But for no obvious reason, the price of staple foods such as maize and rice nearly doubled in a few months. Derivatives of death, they call them. And aren't they just a wonderful tool for saving the planet? You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will, and we'll be right back after the break.
I got some so-called friends. Smile right to my face. All when my back is turned. They like to bury me without a trace. Oh, no, no. Oh, no, no. There's only one thing I need to know. Who's that? Are you on?
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com, proudly brought to you in partnership with GuerrillaMedia.co.nz. We have a guest on the line here with us. Her name is Deborah Brink, and she's one of these kind of people who basically take on a whole bunch of different cases and really just try to do her little bit for humanity despite sleep deprivation and food deprivation. Deborah, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Vinnie. I'm happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Hey, well, you know, everybody needs to have a little chance to talk about what they want to talk about. Now, your most recent case that you're explaining is a guy with dementia who's basically just gone missing. How come are the police helping to try and find this guy, or is it just
Well, we located him. We did law enforcement's job. I need to give credit to someone else because I didn't know we needed to do law enforcement's job. He went missing Friday night about 8 p.m. The Kent County Sheriff's Department Saturday afternoon claims that they put bloodhounds and searchers out there in the field for him. Now, mind you, here we have semis jackknifed shutting down our freeways. It's really cold and we have a big storm. I live in Michigan. It's snowstorm and they can't even take care of accidents. So, you know, I believe that they're out there, but law enforcement doesn't like to cooperate with people. You know, if someone's been missing for a long time, then they might call for some volunteer searchers, but you don't have to be given permission by law enforcement to go put your feet to the ground. So I'm trying to get information and I'm calling, and then I call my Michigan State Police branch, the main one for my entire state here locally. They don't even know the man's missing. And this is like pushing 4 or 5 p.m. on Saturday when he's been missing since 8 p.m. the night before. How does that happen? No one's communicating. So I check back later with the sheriff's department because I've left them my number, told them I'd like to get out there and search, and they claim that they've given my information to the sergeant in the field. After dark, they tried to tell me that they had bloodhounds and a big group of searchers out there. However, the deputy slipped up and that I spoke with and slipped up before telling me that a deputy was on it, but told me it wasn't even up on their board at the sheriff's department. So it's like, can they find their behind with both hands here? Okay. No offense. No. And I said that politically correct here on the air. So, I mean, I do shows that way as I've done hundreds in the past years, but you know, in all defense for law enforcement, they don't learn how to find missing people in cop school, if you want to call it cop school, police academy, whatever. When they go through their training, they don't get much training on missing persons or
yeah, they just teach them how to go.
Right. I mean, they're used to arresting people, writing them tickets, doing their job that way, right? You know, so they don't get a lot of that. Plus, what I find throughout the entire United States on cases is law enforcement doesn't know how to grid search when you need to grid search for a human, for human remains, for someone's loved one. They have no idea what to do. I mean, they go into a large area of acres and they take a dozen people in there and they walk around for an hour and they say it's clear. Sorry. No, grid search is going to take a long time, days to clear that area, you know? It's just, you know, and they don't know these things. But what I didn't know, because I, after getting frustrated and them slipping up, and I know that they don't have big search parties out after dark looking in woods. You can't do that. You know, the big thing when you're searching is burning daylight, guys. You know, so I know this from being out in the field. So I got frustrated and I called someone on the phone who I have as a Facebook friend who has a 501c3 charity. The Missing You Foundation, which is run by Jamie Jones. I dialed him up at 9:26 p.m. Saturday night here. And he didn't know that he lives on the other side of the state. He didn't know that the man was missing in my area. He has a team. They accept no money. They will accept some donations for search equipment, for items they use in the field, but they will accept no money, no rewards, no nothing. They give all their time and spend their own money. They're like me. But he's got a 501c3 charity and he's got a bigger team. So what, and he's been doing it for more years. So he told me first, start calling your hospitals. Now, I would think that's the first thing law enforcement does and ask them if they've got a John Doe because the man has dementia. Alert the hospitals, check the shelters, etc. You see what I'm saying? law enforcement doesn't
well,
do that.
It should be pretty obvious. And, you know, is this an isolated incident just in Michigan?
No,
Or is the whole U.S. police force a bunch of incompetent knobs?
The whole United States, basically, from what I understand. So Jamie told
That's
me to
really
start calling the hospitals. It does sound incompetent, doesn't it? And when I call hospitals and shelters, and they were happy to speak with me, and they one hospital, because there's tons in my area. It's a very big metropolitan area, more than 1 million people, and I live in a southwest suburb. Now, one hospital was called and told to look, watch for the guy by name. One hospital was told a 75-year-old man. None of the others were called at all. They had no description. They didn't know he had dementia. They didn't know what he was wearing, how long he'd been missing, or what he looked like, or have his photo. So I'm a private citizen calling them, wanting to alert them if he's there or a John Doe. This is what he was last wearing. Do you have an email address I can send you a photo to also? Which I did that too. And what happened is, due to the efforts of myself plus Jamie Jones and his whole team that's on the other side of the state, them were calling shelters, and he was also calling contacts he had, which are media contacts and other people, which the sheriff's department in my county doesn't tell media much, and they don't let anybody else help. My county really is bad that way in Michigan, and I found that out. But not many people go missing in my county. It's not a big thing. Like, Florida is the missing persons capital of the world. So I learned a lot this weekend, but Jamie and his team, they did their thing, and Sunday morning it turned out. And Sunday morning, a little Good Samaritan took the man who he had with him for more than 36 hours at his home, thinking he was homeless, to a church-type mission place or to a church so they could get the homeless man a home. He had him in his home for more than 36 hours. He picked him up about 10:30 p.m. Friday night, and they say he was last seen around 8. He saw the man walking and saw he was having a hard time walking in the snow, and it's very, very cold. He talked to him. He thought he was homeless. He had him in his home, feeding him, sheltering him, having him sleep there Friday night, Saturday night, and early Sunday morning takes him to the church to get him shelter so they can find the homeless man a home. So this man had dementia, not knowing who he is and what apartment he lives in and where that is. So you see the situation? So when the Good Samaritan brings him in, they immediately call the Kent County Sheriff's Department because they know the man is missing. How did that happen? That happened because we were working the phones. We were calling these places, sending his photo out there, and we were doing the job that we thought our law enforcement was doing or should have done already.
I can empathize with that because on this show, we're doing the job that the media should be doing. And
That's what I do too.
Yeah, I know. Isn't it funny, right, how the people that are supposed to be trained how to do all these things don't do them and have no idea how to. And when anybody comes in that does know how to do it and offers to help, they refuse help, and you kind of have to do it on your own. Isn't that right?
Well, yeah, Will, what have you got to say about that?
Well, you know, in New Zealand, I mean, my favorite story is the contrast, right? Like, I was thrown out of a council meeting one time just for filming during a public meeting. I didn't even say a word. And I went to the news with this, and I said, look, the council's unlawfully throwing people out of the council just for recording a public effing meeting. You know, this is news. This is big news. This is corruption right in the council. And they said, oh, sorry, we can't slot it in. And I was just like, right. And then a couple of weeks later, I got a footage of a fire in a building. And I called up the news and said, hey, I got this footage of a fire. And they went, really? Were there flames? It just shows a disparity. Yeah, no, it just shows a disparity for me. And you know, it was at that point that I felt very, very justified in what I do, which is making my own news. Because these frickin' scum, and I say that word operatively, can't do it. They're not trained how to do it. They don't have any experience. They don't know nothing about activism. They don't know nothing about the New World Order or the Federal Reserve or corruption in the police force or the judiciary or anything like that. They're just a basic dunce with very well done hair, admittedly, in front of a camera. That's it.
Right.
You know, I'd be surprised.
It's a little different here in America, though. We have a slight difference here with media in America, and I have done shows, co-hosted shows, that we call them, is the media racist? Yes, I've gone that broad. Politically correct, and yes, I have talked with media. I have connections with the national and with locals in many areas. The local media here could not get any information from my sheriff's department, and we do have good local reporters here who were not happy with the response with this missing man case. So I was supposed to be talking with someone. I was instructed by Jamie Jones and given the phone number I needed to talk with this one reporter on Sunday later that day. So I watched my Packer game because our Packers are going to the Super Bowl. I know you're in New Zealand there, Australia, New Zealand, correct, Vinny?
Yeah, it's New Zealand. I mean, we just do rugby here because we're not weak enough to need pads.
Well, I am a cheesehead.
We're not big fans of it because it's just kind of a spectacle that, you know, people should be focused on more important issues personally. But
right, yeah. But, you know, of all sports that there are, my husband and I, we follow football. We follow one team, and that's because we're originally from that city, and that's Green Bay Packers, and that's where family is. So, and Packers is the only team in the NFL owned by the city, not owned by somebody with big bucks who wants to acquire it as a corporation or an enterprise. So that's the only team in the NFL.
Unique.
So it's quite unique. Yes. Yes. So we won going to the Super Bowl. So then I have another problem on my hands and I had to be a good Samaritan, which is why I'm still so tired. I'm tired and I've got to deal with these other things, but we had plans to have, I am a stay-at-home mom still. Plus, you know, I do my advocate work and this type of stuff from home, and I'll go out in the field when I'm needed, but I've been home since 1989, since our first was born. Now my three children are adults, young adults, and you know, their boyfriends, girlfriends come over, their friends come over, and we're going to watch the football games. Well, a friend was here. A 21-year-old of my two daughters, my oldest and youngest child, because I have three kids close together, girl, boy, girl. And she's been part of our family most of her life. We know her well. A neighbor that she barely knows, who she knows the first name of, that she talked to a couple of times and thought that the girl was dealing with 18-year-old drama and never did anything with this girl or had any social contact or anything and only knew her first name and did exchange her cell phone number with her, she got a text that the girl overdosed on Advil, which would be Motrin ibuprofen, and that she wanted to die. And her mom told her, her mom saw her take the pills. Her mom told her, go die. And her mom and the mom's boyfriend left the residence, left the home, left the girl there. So the girl agreed.
Oh man, that is sick.
Before I sent an ambulance. So I didn't meet this girl before. The 21-year-old friend of my child barely knows her, only knows her first name. And we have to go drive to another city around in my metropolitan area and go get this girl. And I did this. So I'm a complete stranger. The 21-year-old is virtually a stranger. The girl said she took Advil. We knew when she went into the hospital, when we took her to the ER, that they're going to do what, you know, what they're mandated by law to do if someone tries to harm themselves, is to transfer them to a psychiatric hospital for an evaluation, which I believe the law right now is a minimum 72-hour hold, which is 3 days. But we had a little snag here, and I ended up having to, along with the 20-year-old, commit her to the mental hospital. What happened was the girl did not have Advil in her system. We spent 15 long hours at that hospital before the transfer, then had to follow the ambulance to the psychiatric hospital, but the hospital lost power to transfer her, so we had to take it. So they run the tox screen to see what she's taken. There's no Advil, Motrin, ibuprofen, or anything like it in her system. She has barbiturates and tricyclic antidepressants in her system. Dangerous drugs. I knew she was
It's the funniest thing how the legal drugs are far more dangerous than the illegal ones.
Well, the system here was broken, and I soon found that out because the girl fully admitted that she intended to kill herself. They asked her, "Do you still feel that way?" She said, "No, They said, what's changed? And this was with the social worker in the hospital, the emergency room doctors, the nurses, the entire staff for many, many hours. What has changed that you don't want to kill yourself anymore? Because they're here. We're two strangers. Okay? So if that's the only thing that changed her mind, plus she didn't have Advil in her system, but she swears she took it out of an Advil bottle. And her mom and her mom's boyfriend said, go die, and left the home after seeing her take the pills. The child is not in a safe home. She is a legal adult, however, so that's where the problem happens. After waiting many hours, they call someone in from an organization called Network 180 that's in my area here. Now, I've heard a lot of horror stories that they're good for nothing but body bags, because they came in for her rights. So this young lady didn't like to be called in around midnight or 1 a.m. or so, you know, to be going to a hospital on Sunday night from her nice warm home, wherever she lives in this metropolitan area. She spent less than 5 minutes with the girl, with the patient, with this young lady who's 18, and decided she's releasing her. The girl told her that she was going to stay with the 21-year-old girl that I had with me, whose mom is out of state, who was going to stay at my house that night, but she's a college student. She works. She's got so much to do and everything else. Plus, her mom is out of state on vacation, but she's 21, so she can be at home by herself. But she was choosing to stay at my house that night, but she couldn't have the responsibility of the girl. I was not going to take in this strange girl, and neither one of us could watch her 24/7 or guarantee her safety. I was not going to transport her in my van away from there, released. I had learned how to overthrow Network 180, though, in the meantime. And the hospital lost its power. The hospital couldn't sign the transfer papers. The Network 180 woman got nasty with me when we met with the staff psychologist at the hospital, the ER doctors, the nurses, this woman who talked to her for 5 minutes, who got called from her nice warm home, and I'd been there hours at her bedside holding her hand, okay, along with this 21-year-old young lady who, let me tell you, she is full adult at the age of 21, you know, with the way she conducts her life, you know, because adult, you know, 18 doesn't mean you're adult, no age, it's the way you conduct yourself. That's how we raise our children, telling them that. It's not a number. It's a responsibility status when you're an adult.
Yeah, yeah. And we will be right back after this quick break, ladies and gentlemen. Our very special guest is Deborah Brink on The Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will at www.thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. That's Vinnie with a Y, because it's the most important question. Back in a moment. And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. I have some interesting news for our Kiwi listeners. You now are visiting the VinnieEastwoodShow.com more than our American listeners. You should be very, very proud of yourself, and I think that is in no small part thanks to our listeners and themselves spreading out the show, because everybody, well, basically needs to hear about this. And also big shout out to our other radio show hosts in Rush FM, particularly Yogi. I just thought I'd throw that in there. Our very special guest who joins us is Deborah Brink. Deborah, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Vinny. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, we were talking about what's his way? 180, the people who are no good for anything but body bags.
Good for body bags is what I call them.
Yeah. Well, you said you got a whole bunch of horror stories. Let's nail them down. Let me finish telling you
what happened at the hospital, because I trumped Network 180. Okay. I steamrolled them. Me and the 21-year-old steamrolled them. Okay, now, nice. Stephanie with Network 180, I do not know your last name. If you're listening to this broadcast, I am filing a complaint against you as a worker in the best interest of a patient. Sad, sad, sad. Shame on you. Okay, done with that now. So we're in the hallway. Stephanie from Network 180, the doctor, social worker, nurses at the hospital, they're all wonderful. And it was very clear from the time we arrived at the medical hospital that this young lady's not going anywhere. They handed me the plastic bag for her personal belongings, and I gave them that to them quick, and they took it and they stored it back behind the nurse's station. She wasn't going anywhere, even though she kept wanting to leave immediately and whining when she gets poked and blah, 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 then doesn't have an answer as to why her system doesn't have Advil, but it's got dangerous drugs in it. So, you know, we're in the hallway. We've got the security guards. We're in the hallway of the ER. So this woman actually got loud and disrupted the other patients in the ER. She tells me in the presence of the social worker, she tells me and the 21-year-old young lady, friend of my children, that the girl is being released and the doctor's standing there, the nurses are, the social worker, security guards, and she said that she's going to go stay with the 21-year-old. Karen said, I'm not staying at my home. I'm staying at Deb's house tonight. And I said, it's not safe for her to go home. That's all I said in a nice, quiet voice. The woman rose her voice nasty to me and said, who do you think you are? You are not her mother. Well, excuse me, but for many, many hours, I've been her mother when her mother said, go die, and went out the door of their home after watching her ingest the pills. So I'm wondering if there's going to be some criminal charges brought on mommy and boyfriend there. You see what I'm saying? So
yeah. Well, the interesting thing is, it's like the state and corporations do far more damage to any family than any neglectful parents, I would say. But continue.
So this is disruption. Then she gets loud in the hallway in the emergency room, disrupting the patients there that need care. The doctors told Karen and I they stopped it, and security officers were nearby. They immediately said for Karen and I. You know, the young lady and I go sit in the waiting room. Her first name is Karen, and I'm quite proud of her. She's like a daughter to me most of her life. She grew up dancing with my daughters. They were dancing since they could stand, both my daughters. So we go sit in the waiting room for just a couple minutes. And because this Network 180 person disrupted the whole ER, and they stopped it. And I didn't say a word back to her. I wasn't going to jump her. I wasn't going to disrupt it. And I wasn't going to do it the wrong way. But I already found out how to steamroll it, because I had heard a horror story earlier in the ER that night, because I happened to bump into somebody while I was waiting for the young lady to go to the bathroom. And I had escorted her there from her hospital bed. But I'll get to that in a second, because this is horrible. The hospital, within a matter of minutes, comes out to get us and wants us to sign witness paperwork that the girl needs to go to the psychiatric hospital. However, we had to continue redoing the paperwork because the hospital lost their power to transfer her. Myself and the 21-year-old, who are virtual strangers, I was a complete stranger. The 21-year-old young lady with me was almost a stranger. Had a couple few second conversations, thought the girl was an 18-year-old drama queen living next door to her, and only knew her first name and had a couple brief conversations with her a little while back. And that's who she reaches out to when she overdoses. So she doesn't have a support system. But anyway, we had to keep changing the paperwork, and it then became that myself and the 21-year-old jointly committed her to the mental hospital, to a very good psychiatric care facility here called Pine Rest Christian services. They're wonderful. It's the best place in the area, and I live in a very large area. Now, in the meantime, I had learned how to steamroll Network 180 if I had to. I didn't have to go this far, though, but I learned, because I was going to refuse to transport the 18-year-old from the hospital, which meant she's stuck there in the middle of the night. She's got no ride, and they're saying they're going to release her, and the hospital doesn't want her released. They want her transferred, and she can't stay at Karen's, and I'm not bringing her home with me, because I can't be responsible to watch somebody who needs psychiatric care. You see what I'm saying? Not that I have a problem taking kids into my home, as my husband and I have done that, and we recently just had one move out that spent more than a year and a half missing, living with us, because he never had a fair shake in life. He's now in his own apartment, and he's doing well. And when he got to us, he was 17 and he was too old to adopt. So he lived here for more than a year and a half. So he's like a child to us. And we've taken in many more through the years. So, you know, anybody needs a place to stay. I mean, anybody's getting abused or anything, or anybody that's a legal adult and they don't have a place to go. you know, or anything like that. I mean, we've even taken in a woman and her children when she left her husband that was abusive. You know, so we're just good Christian people and good people. Although my husband's a very busy man, so he doesn't get involved or know much about my advocate work and doesn't really want to hear me talk about it all the time because he's very tired, you know?
I can relate to that.
60 to 80 hours a week in the office. He wants food and some relaxation and some time with his wife and children when he's home, you know? He's a very busy man, you know? So he's glad with the things I do, you know, and he's happy about it, but he doesn't have time himself to get involved. So I had heard this horror story. Now this is awful because this 21-year-old young man tells me, well, I escorted the lady to the bathroom, carried her IV bag there and, you know, put the blanket around her back so her hiney wasn't hanging out of the gown, you know? So here we go to the bathroom and she's in there going to the bathroom because they flushed IV fluids through her. So she had to get up and go to the bathroom. We ended up speaking to this 21-year-old young man. He caught his best friend trying to hang himself. He was standing on a chair and he had a belt around his neck. His best friend, this young man, got there to save his friend right in time. He snapped the belt and tackled him off the chair before he could do it. There was not any ligature marks from the belt on his neck. He took his friend to a hospital downtown area of where I live here, a different hospital than the one I went to, which is a very good hospital too. There's several in this area. The young man was lying, although his friend's statement was credible. Network 180 stepped in for his rights and sent him home. So this young man realized, though, he found out, he took him home with him, let him sleep at his house, stayed awake, watched him all night. As soon as daylight came up, he drove right to Pinerest Christian Mental Health Center, the best psychiatric hospital, signed papers, and they sent an ambulance to pick him up. Network 180 let him loose. So they're good for body bags. This kid, look what they did there. So I learned I could steamroll him that way too, because I was going to inform them there, I'm not taking her home with me. And if you release her, I'm going right to Pinerest right now and signing papers. We'll be right back with them. And the ambulance will come and get her. See what I'm saying? I learned that I could do that, thankfully, but from this young man named Taylor, who saved his best friend's life. And his friend is fine, got the help he needed, thankfully. But if it had not been for his best friend going to the length that he did and knowing how he and figuring out he could do that, somebody tipped him off to do that. Who knows if his best friend would have hung himself then later.
This is the difference between, people who actually care and are actually involved, or even those people who aren't really involved, but they just basically care, versus those whose job it is to do certain things. You know what I'm saying? There's a real difference here. And I think that, I mean, I used to look after autistic boys, and I find that the lack of training that was given to me was probably, very, very frightening, to tell you the truth. Because I'm a person of conscience, right? But I could imagine that the amount of autonomy that I got looking after kids would basically open up the doorways for abuse and things like this to occur, because there's virtually no oversight and virtually no training. And this is not isolated at all, as far as I know, because of the fact that, hey, almost every single organization known to man that has huge fiduciary responsibilities, you know, and they're operating in the public trust, and they're supposed to, you know, have all these powers and whatnot, they often abuse them, or they just choose to not perform their duties to the extent that they should.
Well, you know what this young lady Stephanie that showed up, you know what her problem was? I can tell you what her problem was. It was very cold. We're trying to recover from a major snowstorm. It's virtually the middle of the night, and she had to come from her nice warm home wherever she lives in this big metropolitan area to show up at the hospital to talk to the 18-year-old young lady. She didn't want to be dragged from her home, and guess what? If she chose to transfer her to the psych facility, if she, after meeting with her, she would have had to stay longer at the hospital, I think, for the paperwork, don't you? So she just wanted to get in and out of there and back home to her nice warm bed, which she did. And I had to take care of business along with the 21-year-old. But Network 180 in this area where I live in the Grand Rapids, Michigan area. There's more than a million people in this metropolitan area, and I live in a southwest suburb. There's lots of suburbs around it. It's like a miniature Chicago with all the suburbs, for those that may not be familiar with the area, but very highly populated, and everyone is supposed to call Network 180 if they have any crisis, if for rape, for abuse, for domestic, you know, battered wives, all battered women, everything, children, everyone is supposed to call Network 180 for help. Guess what? I know of a lot of people that have called them in past years for help, and they never even got their call returned. So that's why I say they're good for body bags, but that's where they're getting funneled to. So we got that system's broken.
Who's funding them?
Well, it's an area organization in the area. I'm not sure if they're, I'm going to look into that because I'm not sure if they're funded by the state, by the county, or what's the deal. I'm not sure who pays for them, because actually, too, I do know that within the legal system that when some people end up in the legal system that, I further found out that night that probation officers and other people have their probationers, you know, the people that did things to be on probation that need counseling, to contact the Network 180 to get it. Now, people have private insurance and can go to good therapists. Now, I've heard a lot of their therapists are, you know, they're not doctors of psychology with the whole alphabet behind their name. So people with private insurance should be allowed to use their private insurance and go see the best of care, right?
Yeah, well, and, you know, probably. You know,
so who's funding them? I don't know, but the legal system's using them too, so I have to check into that. Like I said, I haven't even had a chance to file a complaint.
My assumption would be that it's a state-funded private contractor.
State or county, yeah. Someone's funding them, and, you know, I'm not sure who it is, but the government in some way has to be. They're not, you know, and these people, I'm they must get a lot of volume in their defense, of call volume, but still, I'm sorry. That worker, her name is Stephanie. I don't know her last name. If I did, I wouldn't say it publicly. But if she's listening, I'm filing a complaint. Like I said, I'm coming for you. So, you know, I do the right thing. You know,
now,
I'm out
doing the
right
thing.
And I have a conscience and I'm a good person. And I'm for the right thing and for justice and for what's right. And I'll fight for it. And if I'm right,
well,
I'm not going to back down.
Now, your personal history, I mean, like, how did you get into this advocacy? And we'll touch more on this after the coming break. But just quickly, I mean, what did you used to do before you started advocating for people?
I used to spend a lot of time helping at my church, doing a lot of things for the private day school there. Our children went kindergarten through eighth grade to a private Lutheran school. For the regular schooling that had 50 some kids, sometimes 60 some kids on any given year, kindergarten through eighth grade with five teachers. And it was, and we had no busing. We're very small. We've got 200 and some families in our church. You know, I'm Lutheran. And so I spent a lot of time there with the church and the school, and also helping people from the church.
All right. And more into this after the break. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Our guest is Deborah Brink at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com and GorillaMedia.co.nz. We'll be right back, folks.
Some kind of way out of here, said a joker to the thief. There's too much confusion, I can't get no relief. Businessman there, drink my wine, plowman dig my earth. None will level on the mine, nobody
hey. And we are back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com. Of course, our very special guest joining us for this final segment of the first hour is Deborah Brink. And Deborah, I wanted you to sort of divulge. You used to be a businesswoman, is that correct?
Correct. My husband is an engineer, and shortly after we were married in 1987, we just had our 24th wedding anniversary earlier this month. We left Wisconsin, Green Bay, Wisconsin, for New York for him to start his engineering career. He's 6 years older than I. I was 18. He was 24 when we met. I had college training in high school, so I was good to go, had a job, lived on my own, everything else when I met him. But yes, I worked corporate business. I worked for U.S. Borax and Chemical Corporation. And there, if you look at the 20 Mule Team Borax and the laundry section, laundry detergent and stuff like that, people use that borax in their, for their laundry. But what U.S. Borax and Chemical did was mine the boron out in California and transport it by big, rail cars all over the country. And they formed many different chemicals from it. So we had, you know, chemical samples in the office. Prior to that, I had worked for a private ambulance company and wheelchair transport company in Wisconsin, a law firm and a big insurance company. So I had training in a lot of areas. Then I had to learn bulk chemicals and all the material safety data sheets, technical data sheets. And I assisted the senior technical representative there on the East Coast. He's a chemist. So I had to learn this stuff and start doing business administration things in that office for bulk chemicals. So that was a whole new thing to learn, but that's what I did. And we ran the whole East Coast in that office. And 6 days before I had my first child, I was told I couldn't commute anymore. And because I was 4 centimeters dilated, they didn't want me to go into labor. And I chose to stay home with my children. And I'm still a stay-at-home mom, although I'm launching my own business, plus my advocacy work now. And I'm also launching my own news site for print, along with my own broadcasting channels, as I've co-hosted shows for years. I've had offers to co-host shows that had nothing to do with advocacy because they liked my style, but I didn't have time for that because I'm too busy trying to be an advocate, and that's expanding, and I've got so many people wanting, more people wanting help than I have time to help. And I've got some good people that are going to help me, you know, do the administration and things on my sites. So there's a lot of, you know, great people, and, you know, one person that I've talked to and I ran across her case was Amy Sharon that you had on. And I'm going to be talking with her again later tonight. So, you know, I help anyone who I'm on the side of what's right. Now, like I said, I usually, it was the cases where, you know, mommy and daddy report a child missing, mom and boyfriend do, but, and then they run around rocking the Find Me t-shirt of the kid, right? With their picture on the front, when I know from right out of the gate that they need to stop rocking that t-shirt and fess up. And I call them out on the air for it too. I've done it through the years, and I've got websites for children up that no one put websites up to help them, to help locate them. They all need a website. You know, internet can be very powerful. You can help locate people with a telephone and a computer. You know, if they're missing, that's what we did for the local man here. Phones and computers. You see what I'm saying? You know, that I spoke about earlier. So my business experience, I believe with all the organizational, I did so much administration and I planned our shows and I admin all the forums and the websites. Now I've got my own server. I own many websites and I'm going out on my own because my co-host became ill this past year, and it'll be a while before he's back to himself. And at that point, I'll co-host shows with him and work with him some more. But I'm going out on my own too. And my listeners and audience are patiently waiting for the launch of that. So I'm not going to quit. I'm going to keep going. And, you know, it just doesn't stop. Someone needs my help, I'm there.
Well, I'd like to thank you very much for coming on the show with us today. Do you have any websites you'd like to fire out?
I'd like to fire out findaji.com, findgabriel.com, justiceforrobert.com, justiceforhaley.com. And I'd like to let you know that Sharing Hope News Network is under construction and will be moved on to my server now that I recently got and be up and running. And Sharing Hope News Network is the name of my new show. And I have things, you know, because Sharing Hope is what it's all about, no matter what you're dealing with. And my husband came up with that title along with my oldest daughter. That's getting a makeover and being moved on to my server. So it's under construction, but it is up and running, sharinghopenewsnetwork.com. But there's really not much there except a note for me. Be patient, guys. I'm moving it. And we're going to get rocking and rolling with the show pretty quick, too.
All right, Deborah. Well, thanks very much for coming on the show. And also, I'd like to just make this point here that advvocacy, really, Andy, is very, very effective. You know, you can get a heck of a lot done if you're a person of good conscience and good skill, just wanting to get it done, and you don't necessarily need any monetary reward in order to obtain it. So thanks to Deborah for coming on the show. And you are a great example for many people out there.
Thank you, Vinny.
All right, there she goes. Deborah Brink, ladies and gentlemen, on the Vinny Eastwood Show with Will. Coming up next hour, we've got some more news and another fabulous guest coming at us live from New Zealand on our Kiwi Collaborator segment at the VinnyEastwoodShow.com. Number two of the Vinny Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and the VinnyEastwoodShow.com, proudly brought to you in collaboration with GorillaMedia.co.nz, New Zealand's unconventional news. Now, there's so many. The weather is getting real bad worldwide, ladies and gentlemen, and it's pretty rough, quite frankly. And this is expected, of course, because mainstream media has not reported on the true cause of some of the uber bad weather, in my opinion, caused a lot to do with the Gulf Stream shutting the F down, thanks to the Gulf of Oil Cano incident. Resulting in, this article here, Arctic air blast brings temperatures of 50 below to New England. Bangor in Maine, train equipment froze, Cars sputtered, schools cancelled classes, and cold weather enthusiasts stayed inside Monday as a bitter blast of below zero temperatures with potentials for minus 50 degree wind chills gripped the northeast. On top of the cold, overnight snow is prompting a call to slow down on the main turnpike. At 6 a.m. Tuesday, the Turnpike Authority reduced the speed to 45 miles an hour on the turnpike from Kittery to exit 109 in Augusta. The National Weather Service is predicting up to an inch of snow before 1 p.m. in to make the roads slippery, so watch out. And also another article in here, which is one of maybe 10 articles from different news sources that I've read over the years that have this exact same headline: scientists fear MMR linked to autism. New American research shows that there could be a link between the controversial MMR triple vaccine and autism and bowel disease in children. It's like, and again, I've heard this so many times that it's just undeniable now. In fact, it's been undeniable for quite some time if you look at any of the evidence, which very few people do. And let me just give you a little bit of a brief rundown. Mercury is not good for you, okay? I know that's news to some people. Perhaps it's really good to, like, you know, chomp down on your thermometers. But they put it in vaccines. And the news reports come out on Fox frickin' News saying, oh, mercury is really good and it may help, not harm you, according to these new studies that were published by vaccine manufacturers who have a vested interest. Oh, the denial. The study appears to confirm the findings of British doctor Andrew Wakefield, who caused a storm in 98, by suggesting a possible link. Indeed, there's been studies coming out of the Netherlands and all over the place confirming this as a pretty much solid reality, despite denial from vaccine manufacturers. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will. I wouldn't advocate not vaccinating your children because I'm not a medical doctor, but I ain't going to vaccinate mine if I have some.
Black sunrise.
And welcome back to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Ladies and gentlemen, our Kiwi collaborator for today is a man named Gordon Parlane. Welcome to the program, Gordon.
Thank you.
Now, you've been, sexually assaulted by a friend of the police on Waiheke in 1996, and the case is still, it's still a little bit effed up. Could you let us know what happened? What was this incident?
I was on a private chartered fishing boat called the Doolittle. Nick Towns was the skipper, and it had five paying customers upon it, which I was one included. Upon that boat, 20 minutes into the fishing trip from Matea Harbour, a person named Warwick Terence Cole of then 2 Onatangi Road, Onatangi, came up behind me and viciously, without my knowledge, slammed something on my rectum and my anus, right on the datum. And that item was a knife, which was encased in a fisherman's knife, encased in two metal, a wooden handle with a wooden sheath. When you put the knife into the handle, into the sheath, it just looked like a piece of wood, which he kept in his pocket. And immediately it happened, I felt the pain in my brain trying to escape out the top of my head.
Now, you also went to his place after this and a scuffle broke out, and the police were called to the scene. And what did they do?
Firstly, I went to the skipper's house on the Sunday evening, the day after the incident, explained to him what happened. I asked him for my money back. His wife thought I was getting angry, said she would call the police. I said I would remain there until they came. Then Mr. Towns gave me my money back, and I left. The next day, Monday, at 1:30 roughly, I went into the toilet of my girlfriend's house while she was at work to remove my bowels. I was sitting on the toilet trying to move my bowels. I was in great pain. I was looking at the verse of Desiderata in front of me on the toilet wall. The pain was so immense, with tears to my eyes. And a vision of Warwick Demon's Coal came into my mind.
And it seems that the incident is still fresh in your mind. And, you know, this is not an isolated incident at all. You know, sexual assault does happen, and it really destroys people's lives. Please tell us more.
I went to Warwick Cole's house approximately 8 p.m. Monday evening. As I walked onto the property, two dogs walked out. Came out barking. A man appeared on a balcony above in the dark and called out, "Who's there?" I replied, "It's Gordon Warwick. I've come to see you about an incident that occurred on the boat 2 days ago." And he quickly said, no, nothing happened. Nothing happened at all. I walked where he was and stood below him and clearly and calmly said to him, "Yes, it did happen, Warwick. I'm come here to see you about it." And he repeated again, no, and brushed it off. Nothing happened. And then I persisted with my claim that he had sexually assaulted me. And after a couple of minutes, he kind of went a bit limp and went, "Oh, yeah, it might have happened. Sorry." And on that admission, I went to the left of the balcony to see if there were stairs up there. There was none. I went to the right. There was none. So I went back, stood below him, sighted a pole below him, and hand over foot, I went up that pole. He watched me come up over the balcony. His head was right there. I then stood in front of him and said, "Now, why did you do it?" He immediately started to go into reverse. No, I didn't know nothing like that. You got the wrong address. You don't know what you're talking about. Well, the pain in my butt was not lying. And with respect to myself, I reached over and I gave him a slight thump on the left cheek. At that moment, he dropped his shoulder, took two steps back, roared like a hungry lion, and he crawled into me, took me around my midriff, had me over the balcony. For 3.5 minutes, I was lying with bruises just the top of my hips where the balcony was, the balcony rail, and the rest of my upper body was hanging over the balcony with a drop about 25 feet below. This occurred. This went on for 3.5 minutes. Approximately, and Mr. Warwick's Coal position was like a man on a woman. He was lying right across my body, my head hanging over the balcony, and his head right on my face. And I was quite repulsed. It took me another 3.5 minutes to work him off me, where I started to squirm my right thumb into his right eye, and I pushed it in up to about a half before he relented and got his body off me, and then I laid into him and he laid into me. We had a good fight. When I started to get the better of him, he then recoiled into a corner and started to cry, act like a coward, start crying. His wife had to call the police. I said, "Well, that's good. I'm not going nowhere. I'm staying here till they come." After about 2.5 minutes, I started to notice that he was whispering to his wife, the tin, the gun. Get the gun. When I would not relent him and let him out of the corner of the balcony because he wanted to go inside, I was afraid for the gun. He then charged me again. It was in the dark on the balcony. It was a long balcony. He charged me about 20 meters, took me with his weight right through four tables, four chairs, two tables, right to the end of the balcony. He was trying to get me over the balcony again. We ended up on the ground. He had my head. We were both on our fours. He had my he had me grasped by the head and the hair. I had him grasped with one hand on the head and one hand under the chin. He tried to slip my thumb into his mouth and bite, where I pulled my hand away. I realized I had a free hand. I pushed his head into the balcony floor. He screamed. He turned around and went to dive into the house. He had moved up unbeknown to him from the ranch slider, and he crashed into the two bottom panes of the French doors leading to his child's window. He then immediately pulled himself out of that, squirmed across the balcony deck, and I last seen him crawling fervently over the threshold of the ranch slider into the house. I feared for the gun. I immediately dropped over the balcony and ran to the cover of the hedge in case he shot me. He then screamed out, "Come back, Gordy. Come back, Gordy. Come back and fight me now." And I screamed out to him, "You tell the police." And he said, "No, you tell the police, Gordon, or Gordy." And I then went home and I heard a knock on the door 8 o'clock the next morning, Tuesday morning.
And it was the police at your door, wasn't it? Now, this man, Mr. Cole, he was indeed friends with these police officers. He's one of their fishing buddies, was he?
Very much so. On the fact he had gone out on this boat previously the week before with Michael Wardlaw, who was also on the boat. Michael Wardlaw was also on the boat when I went out. And Warwick Cole is a friend of Constable Alfred Blair, badge number F329, and it is well known.
Okay, now they took you in to the police station and they sat you down. They decided to try and take you seriously, but then they changed their tune all of a sudden. What happened there?
He asked me at my girlfriend's house he came to see me about an incident at Cole's house the evening before. I said, "Yes, that's correct. I was there." I said, "But it all started 2 days ago on a boat." He jotted down in his notebook and subsequently signed it, "Okay, on the boat, I'll get that in writing. Will you accompany me to the police station to make a statement?" I clearly state, "Yes, I would." And it's noted in this police notebook and signed by him. I went to the police station with him. We were 10 pages into a writing of what happened. And then he asked me, "When did you assault him?" Well, firstly, when I was telling him what occurred to me on the boat, he was acting repulsively and saying, "Ooh, I don't like that." Well, that's the facts. That's what happened. He then asked me, "When did you assault him?" Before I could reply, I noticed that he was writing in, "I assaulted him." I then pulled him up and said, "Excuse me, you asked me a question. Before I have formulated my answer, you have already written down it." He got very aggressive, said, "Are you trying to tell me something I've never heard?" I said, "No, you simply asked me a question. Before I formulated an answer, you have written down yours. I want to talk to my lawyer. I terminate the statement." He asked me to rip the paper out and have it, and we can start again. I said, "No." He then screwed the paper up and asked me to take it. I said I would not, because he would say then that I did it. He then abandoned the statement. It was terminated in mid-sentence. He then took me into a room to ring a lawyer. He then stood over me and said, "If you weren't sitting on that chair, I would damn well knock you effing off it." I rang my lawyer since then. Shortly after that, he just said, "Well, you know, the police say nothing. Give me your name and address and that's it." Mr. Alfred Blair, Constable F329, escorted me outside of the police station to the cell blocks. He said because I did not go through with the statement, he was going to charge me with a more serious charge. as we accompanied a two-man cell block. He opened up the grill to the cell. I stepped forward to go in, and his comment caught my attention. He said, just off the record, as I said, it caught my attention. I turned my head. He put his face right into mine in an intimidating manner, and with a cheesy grin, asked me if he had had a big raja and was his penis out. I said, that's a very serious comment. Do you mind repeating that in front of my lawyer? Which he replied, yes, you do. And a few lawyers later, maybe another one more, I still endeavour to have this case looked at.
Now, you've had difficulties, in fact, getting the court case itself even heard. You've told me that you've been going to court numerous times, and sometimes the police don't even show up.
On my first appearance in the court for a defendant hearing on the 30th of January, if my memory is correct, I attended the court in the Auckland District Court, and the police did not appear. And the lawyer of that time asked for it to be removed from the court and was denied. And as was on two other occasions, and as on was the last occasion, the police did not appear in court. Yet on the 6th of December, 97, when I came over from Waikiki Island on the ferry to go to the court, I noticed Alf Blair walking down Queen Street towards the ferry, and it struck me as odd. When I appeared in court, I was informed that there was no police representative in the court. The lawyer presented to the judge that the case should be chucked out. The judge refused, and then the lawyer in question said that if I did not do anything smart and plead guilty, he would walk out on the case. And he made me give a voluntary plea of guilty, which on appeal, he wrote in an affidavit to the judge that requested that affidavit from him. This was my 11th appearance in court over a period of 11 months.
Now, you've also experienced some arrests after this incident in case, and it kind of accounts to police harassment. One case in particular was when you were arrested for, doing nothing really. Some witness supposedly said that you'd broken into a car, which happened to be your own car, while you were getting your kids some Subway outside of Auckland Hospital. What happened there?
Well, firstly, before that, 4 years after the date I was sexually assaulted on Waikiki Island on the boat called the Doolittle on the 2nd of November 1996, 4 years later to the very day after I had moved off Waikiki Island, purchased two houses, I was arrested again. And my son, 12-year-old son, was removed from me to a safe place on a prostitute's word. And he was taken to a safe place, apparently, where he was molested by a paedophile ring in a town I will not yet disclose. But I know the police did not inform the community of the paedophiles in that area.
Absolutely horrific story. And it was, in fact, one of my listeners who's currently living in China, I believe, who sent me the details of his dad and that kind of thing. And I had him come round here, and he travels with a decent pile of documents with him that I had a chance to peruse through. And... man, it's one of the most horrible things. And on this show, we do try to make light of terrible situations, but there's some that I'm not sure if I can, and I believe it would be disrespectful to do so, this being one of them. It's indicative of a wider problem, of course, and this is by no means isolated case, as virtually none of the guests that we have on here who've had terrible things happen to them are isolated cases either. You know, I mean, they're all unique, but they're all basically, six sheets to the wind, whatever that means. It's, yeah, I think that it's the job of the media to give a voice to the voiceless. If you don't do that, you're not a member of the media. All right, that's it, because you've abdicated your responsibilities. You shouldn't receive any benefits from it. And, you know, I'd apologize for the listeners. I probably should have warned you about the graphic nature of our guest today, but it's just sometimes you really don't need to hear. Anyway, regardless of whether or not you want to, so that you can understand what people go through and you can understand the enemy of humanity and all that entails, what they do and how to stop them. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will.
I was toting my pack along the dusty
one of 3 years after that. I was then coming back to the hospital incident. My daughter complained of a hip ailment. I took her to our doctor. He made arrangements for me to go to the hospital to see a specialist with her. The arrangements were made and in place. I did take her to the hospital. Specialist did see her. They admitted her. At 6 o'clock, I waited there all day from 9 a.m. to 6. And then after she was admitted, I returned home to get her toiletries, pajamas. And when I arrived back, she stated that she was a little bit stiff and hungry. So herself, we obtained crutches from the nurses, explained to them that I was just taking her over to the subway to buy a subway for her with my son, younger son. We walked out of the hospital. We went to the subway, which is right across the road. I brought them what they required. We sat in the bus shelter opposite the hospital by the pedestrian crossing. And while my children were finishing their meal, I walked around a side street where our car was parked 5 meters up the road to retrieve a box of matches. I'm walking back from the car to the bus stop. I noticed a lady across the road crossed diagonally right in front of me, staring at me. And it was something that I could not figure out until later. Returned to the bus stop. Children had finished their meal. This was about 8:30 in the evening. We'd been out of the hospital 5 minutes. I was escorting my daughter on crutches. She had one arm, her right arm and my left arm. Crutches, two crutches in her hands. I had her handbag. And she was leaning on me and my son was beside us. As I walked across the pedestrian crossing, a police car pulled up, stationary at the pedestrian crossing. Once my family and I touched the pavement, the passenger policeman jumped out. He was a Chinese man, jumped out, went into a squat position, pointed his finger at me as if like a gun, and yelled out, "Stop, you're under arrest. You have been seen to have done a crime in the vicinity recently." My children and I were immediately stunned, shocked, and just could not believe it. There were over 50 people outside the hospital of various ages and descriptions and gender, and some in hospital gowns, smoking, taking it all in. And the second policeman driving the car parked his car on the footpath and got out. And from there, he was adamant that I had done a crime. To no avail, my family and I tried to put the truth across what our time had become of leaving the hospital. He became very abusive towards me. When he asked me my details, where do I live, he'd mutter under his breath, "Nowhere in particular. Do I have any children?" Obviously not. And I was trying to correct him to say, "You are putting incorrect details into the notebook. I would like you to correct that." He then read out my Bill of Rights, then paused mid-sentence and stopped. I made him read out the Bill of Rights again. That would be correct. I informed him emphatically he was falsely arresting me. I had not done a crime. And I requested his number off his badge. And when I said that, he immediately put me under arrest for requesting his number of his badge, and yet it's there for the public to view and for the public to obtain. He handcuffed me behind my back, placed me in the back of the police car, and then went to check the scene of the crime. He returned 15 minutes later. I could tell by his body language that there was a difference in his air. As he was walking up to the police station, I called out through the window, "You had better be letting me out of here." He reached across me to undo the seatbelt. I was still handcuffed. I said, "There was no window broken, was there?" He did not reply. I repeated it. "There was no window broken, was there?" No reply. I gritably spoke into his ear, "There was no window broken, was there?" And he grittedly replied back, "No, there isn't." And he released me from that point. I've had a long association with a lawyer over this case for over 2-3 years. And when I requested the policeman's notebook, he did send in the notebook. I believe the details are inaccurate. And he also made a statement. And I believe that was wrong, because he only asked, requested his notebook, and he made a statement and basically gave his word first, his version of events. And as before, I've noticed of the police, they tend to play a vantage first.
Now, the current status of the case, I mean, you've been trying to get hearings for this, you've been in and out of the High Court, and, you know, what's currently happening?
As of September last year, I came into contact with the police again. They gave me a fine for not paying my diesel tax, road user taxes. And then on conversation, the policeman asked me when was the last time I had been in court, to which I started to think a very long time ago, I said. He said, "September 01, I said, "Yes, I think you are right. I think it was September 01. He related to me that there was an outstanding warrant going back over 8 years and that I should immediately get myself to the court and sort it out. It took me a few weeks to sort it out, as the file was in the archives. Turned out it was at the Henderson Police District Court where the sentence was to have occurred. I went there, spoke to a lawyer. I produced papers from 8 years ago, showed him the papers. He exclaimed that it was wrong, that they could not have sentenced me to what they did, and that it was incorrect, and that he did understand what I was trying to say to him. And on my second appearance there, which I was wishing to fight it, the lawyer spoke with the corrections and they withdrew it. And that lawyer, I was able to show some papers that I've had relating to the previous incidents, as I have mentioned. And after showing him facts, categorical facts, he is of the mind that there has been an injustice done to me and my family.
In terms of the level of injustice that was in fact done to you, I mean, what kind of police are culpable here? How did they cover this up at all?
Yes, they did. And I'd clearly like to state at this opportunity that the reason why this case has lingered for so long is that there has been and is an obstruction of justice on behalf of the police. Upon making the statement in Waikiki Island Police Station, after the policeman locked me up, he then proceeded to go back into the interview room where he completed the statement in his own hand, came to 11 pages, and he signed his name, Alfred Blair, Constable F329, stating that Gordon Parlane refused to sign. But Mr. Blair put his signature to it, and I believe he has incriminated himself by that, because he then subsequently wrote out a 2-page police summary of facts. It states, upon apprehension, Mr. Parlane gave no explanation whatsoever.
Well, that sounds very, very corrupt of him. You know, and Alf has been a quite, you know, well-known on the island, as Orby was pretty much the longest-serving police officer. He's been there for somewhat of 10 years. And now you're telling us that he's proceeded to help cover up a sexual assault case involving one of his good friends, and indeed wrote false statements in order to do so.
Well, it was very plain to see, because I have in possession an 11-page statement with Alfred Lear's signature on it. I also have the summary of facts statement made by him, stating that I gave no explanation whatsoever. When a statement is taken by the police like that, it becomes state evidence. It's not his to withdraw or hold from the courts. After the nonsense that occurred from him, I engaged a private investigator, a former superintendent of the Auckland CBD. I've had two reports from him. One report, he slams the police to the point where he states whoever wrote out the summary of facts to the court and seriously misled the courts.
Okay. And what's next for you with this case? I mean, are you still in and out of court or what?
I am still progressing with my current lawyer. And I do hope that the light of day will see the truth.
All right. I'd like to thank you very much, Gordon, for coming on the show with us today. Do you have any final statements for us?
I do. Policemen seem to think they're above themselves to the point that when you exit the loo, they feel they don't stink. I'd like to say more, but I think that's quite apt. I'd like to thank Mr. Eastwood for the opportunity to say what I have, and I actually state categorically I have the facts and evidence before me, and the only reason it has not got to the court because of obstruction from the police. I also have 15, 16 private and confidential papers received from New Zealand Police Headquarters under the Official Information Act at my request to the then and still is MP of Titirangi, David Cunnilliffe. These papers are very revealing and speak for themselves.
Thank you, Gordon, for sharing your story with us here on the Vinnie Eastwood Show.
Yep. Some of the worst kind of things that you could ever conceive of. And a lot of people have actually gone through incidents like he has. And, you know, it's very clear from how he portrays it. They're still very much with him. You know, these kind of things don't go away. And that's the real tragedy, is that it can happen once and it'll affect you for the rest of your life. That's what this kind of abuse really results in, is damaged human beings. And, you know, there'd be a lot of people out there who think that, oh, that's horrible, that's disgusting, I don't want to hear about that. Well, you got to hear about it. If you refuse to talk about these things that you really are uncomfortable with, you're never going to be able to stop them, are you? You know? I mean, what about you, Will? I mean,
that's the whole thing, you know. That's the whole thing about, oh, don't bring up certain topics with certain people. Stuff it, man. No, here we are. This isn't a dress rehearsal. If you've got an issue with someone or something, I mean, take it up with them. Really? I mean, this is why the police are perceived. Oh, yes, bad things happen, but, you know, the majority of what they do is good, and we just need to tolerate all the bad things. And that's how those opinions are formed, because people don't want to expose, don't want to think about the bad side of things.
Well, because the implications are quite vast, aren't they? You know, I mean, if this is happening in one small community, what's to say it's not happening on a grand scale? And I've talked to many, many people who have been victims of police corruption in New Zealand. And, you know, my faith in the police has been absolutely shattered. Not that I had any to begin with, but I would...
That's the thing, Vinny. If you can see that corruption happens in a microcosm scale, then if you extrapolate that, you can probably see, oh, okay, the world operates on a corrupt basis also. But you see, it's okay for the media to say, oh, there's a real estate scam going on here, or there's, you know, some lending scam there, or Nigerian scam here. So it's okay to look at these small minutiae and how corruption occurs on minute levels. But then for you to say that, oh, maybe the UN, maybe the US, maybe all our institutions here, global institutions, are corrupt and part of something bigger, well, that's a grandiose conspiracy theory. You're anti-Semitic now. That's how they paint it, you see? You can't... People don't realize that this is the operating principles of the universe. People are going to conspire. People are going to consolidate power. People are going to, you know, cozy up to their powers and try and outdo you.
Yep. Sad but true. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, proudly brought to you in partnership by GorillaMedia.co.nz. And we'll be right back. Final segment coming up.
We're gonna make love. You know how I know? Because it's Wednesday, and Wednesday night is the night that we usually make love. It's because it's when everything is just right. There's nothing good on TV. You haven't had your social netball team practice, so you're not too tired. Oh yeah, sounds like it's all on. You say something to me like, I might go to bed, I've got work in the morning. But I know what you mean. You mean, oh yeah, it's business time. It's business time.
It's business. It's business time.
Yeah.
That's what you mean. You mean it's business time.
Oh. It's business. It's business time.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the show that's all about business time. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and incidentally the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, proudly brought to you by GorillaMedia.co.nz. Now, there's two financial con artist scum that I'd like to give special mention here to. The first is the obvious one, Goldman Sachs. It says no U.S. investors for Facebook offering. If anyone tells you that the U.S. dollar is not in trouble, you can prove it. How? Read the story from the Associated Press. All right. This is available on the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, ladies and gentlemen. Goldman Sachs has prohibited U.S. investors from participating in a private offering expected to raise up to $1.5 billion for social networking site Facebook, citing widespread media coverage that could run afoul of securities guidelines. The investment bank said on Monday it had decided to restrict the fund to prospective shareholders in Asia and Europe because it determined that the news coverage could be inconsistent with the laws that govern private placements. In a statement, Goldman Sachs said it made the decision on its own and believes this is the most prudent path to take. Yeah, kind of like derivatives of death. Very frickin' prudent. Scum. I swear to God. What? I want to cut off their Goldman Sachs, I swear to God. Because
They don't have any, Vinny.
Oh, yeah.
The spineless little wimp turds who hide behind accounting degrees think they're smart because they can collude with each other. But I mean, speaking of taking our power back, I wanted to give special mention to a New Zealand activist and listener to the show, and I'm not sure whereabouts he's based at the moment, but Christopher Wingate. I won't bother going into his history, but Christopher's organising a protest here in New Zealand on the 1st of May Illuminati day, I'd have to say. But anyway, 1st of May, 9 a.m. in outside of Parliament in Wellington here in New Zealand, outside the Masonic Beehive and the Masonic Temple Chamber next door to it. And so hopefully, if you're interested in taking this country back, as Christopher says in his blog here, we are the third most indebted nation in the OECD. As all our listeners know, we're borrowing over $300 million a week just to pay our bills. All that comes with interest, of course, thanks to our central banker scum. And we talk about investors in this country, 232,000 of them losing $8.5 billion. It goes on, it goes on, it goes on. This government's criminal. They're not accountable. There's secret proceedings everywhere. We're literally living in this island paradise run by little hook-nosed demons. Call themselves John Key.
This dovetails, in fact, with an article that came out today, is Key is set to set out the government's next steps tomorrow. Get this. This is irony statement of the year. We need to increase our national savings so that we can control our destiny as a country. Is that why you're getting that country in debt? $300 million a week. He says our high level of foreign debt is New Zealand's biggest vulnerability. Of course it is. You're the one who did it.
To be fair, it goes back to Helen Clark. It goes back to all of them since Norman Kirk, you know, that they're just all scum, all filth, all maggots, and then all this little pathetic idiot brain supporters. You know, I'm talking to them too, because they really are filth. I get these patronizing little flies from this Nikki K doe-eyed little thing who is my local MP for National, and then there's a Labour one, Jacinda Ardern, and she's climate change, killed Africa, and between the two of the little scum. You know, I've seen them in person, and I've asked them questions, and they're just like, not the time or the place, okay? We need to talk, I don't know, gay marriage or something, whatever ridiculous little side issues that Nikki Kaye's into. She hangs out with one of my cousins who thinks he's a National Party shill. Got other family who've worked for the National Party. They're idiots too. It's just past the power, isn't it? We've got these people saying we need to strengthen our local economy. She's got this flyer, Nikki Kaye. We need to strengthen by providing more jobs. Unofficial unemployment in this country is around 12%. Officially, it's around 7% right now. There's people who've applied for the DPB in the last 6 months. We're in free fall here.
Yeah, it's
and we're borrowing above our heads. We're just like a drunken gambler at the table, and they're going, don't worry, vote for us. I can smile at you all day. And suckers believe in it. They believe in it because they go, well, what else do you want to do? She's the lesser of two evils.
Key said in his speech that the one he would give when Parliament resumes on February 8th, he said it would show the difference between the government's fiscally responsible approach to creating a sound economy and Labour leader Phil Goff's proposals. What fiscally responsible approach?
Look, Vinny, it's like choosing between Medusa and I don't know, Attila the Hun or something for wives. You know, you've got two demons to choose from in the world as your partner, as your life partner. Who are you going to side with? Well, I'll stay abstinent, thank you very much. We need abstinence from government.
Who are you going to call? And John Key has a 900 number. And John Key has a 900 number, ladies and gentlemen.
Christopher Wingate is organising the 1st of May Idiots in Power protests here in New Zealand, down in Wellington. Please email Christopher at newzealandmay1@gmail.com and be there.
And we're going to keep promoting that because his idea is to withdraw parliamentary immunity and judicial immunity. The only reason why these scum are selling our country down the river is because we're unable to hold them to account. And it's about time that we change that and find somebody to do it. And that person is you. We'll be right back tomorrow.